It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lam. For over 10 years, Gail Simmons has decided the fate of hopeful chefs from all over the country. She's a judge on the show Top Chef, and she takes her job super seriously. And I know because I worked with her as a judge on the spinoff Top Chef Masters. And I was so struck by how thoughtfully she would taste the food, and how smartly she critiqued the dishes, and how carefully she'd decide who had to pack up their knives. But at home, Gail is, well, you know, she's just like most people. She often cooks simply and quickly, you know, works hard to feed her kid, and just gets something tasty on the table. But that idea of tasty is informed by years of eating incredible food all over the world, which makes her a perfect person for our series, The Key Three, where we talk to good cooks about the three things they think everyone should know how to make. We met up at a place called Haven's Kitchen in New York City to cook together.
Well, Gail, so great to see you.
Thank you, Francis. I always love hanging with you.
It's been a little minute.
I know.
You have eaten everywhere.
A lot of places.
Okay.
A lot of
almost
food.
Literally everywhere. Yeah. you literally have chefs falling over themselves to impress you on a daily basis.
That sounds
I've been there with you
romantic.
When it's happened. So the question is, what do you cook at home for yourself?
That's a good question. It's funny, I actually get this question a lot.
Yeah.
Well, the question usually starts as, do you cook at home? Because people, I think, who specifically watch me on Top Chef always see me in a very certain way. It is me, but it is a very curated, kind of edited version of me.
Sure.
And I'm often in like full hair and makeup and a cocktail dress. So they don't know if I actually cook or if I just sit and eat and judge people, which I do a lot of.
In your regular life.
Yeah, I'm just judging everybody, wearing a cocktail dress. Now that I have a job that requires me to travel a lot and to eat a lot out, I find, especially as I get older and now that I have a child, that my food at home is much simpler.
Yeah.
Because there's not a lot of time. And at the end of the day, when I've also been working and eating a lot of heavy food during the week, I want to come home and just eat really simple, delicious,
just like
fresh
go-tos, like lots of things you don't have to think too hard about.
That's it.
So tell us about some of them. Tell us about, let's say three.
There are many. I've been thinking a lot about this. But there's three things that, in my head, are my go-to, really, that deeply satisfy me, that I love to make. They are chicken wings.
You are my best friend.
Thank you. I've always loved a chicken wing, butterscotch pudding, and a really perfect fried egg sandwich.
These are solid choices.
They are not necessarily every single day recipes. You're
sure.
not going to eat butterscotch pudding and chicken wings every day of the week. But they are three things that I feel like are great things to know how to make for entertaining, for pleasing yourself, and they are just three of my favorite things to cook.
Right on. So talk to me about the chicken wings.
Sure. Growing up in Toronto, there was a place from as far back as I can remember, probably middle school, where my friends and I always went for chicken wings. The best, spiciest chicken wings, crispy fried wings with an incredible dilly ranchy sauce.
Oh, cool.
And I've never been able to replicate those wings, but in the process, I have found other ways to make wings that I love. But there's just nothing to me more satisfying, more sort of decadent and silly and tasty, because it hits all the points. There's the fat and the salt and the heat.
Sure. And then butterscotch pudding. Can I confess something to you?
Yeah.
Like, we're both food professionals.
Yes.
Okay, there is a microphone on me right now, but like in our private moment. Like,
understood.
I don't
just
know.
Just between us.
I don't know what butterscotch is.
So.
What is butterscotch?
You know, it's a funny thing. This is the road I went down. What the hell is butterscotch? where does it come from? And my original belief was, well, it probably is two things, butter and scotch, which makes sense, would be in the recipe. So I had to go down a pretty deep rabbit hole. There's very little on the internet about this. Apparently, the scotch part of it comes from what possibly could be a word for scorch.
Huh.
Because you scorch the butter a bit, you brown
okay.
the butter with
okay.
sugar in the process of making it to caramelize it. And that's the best I could find for what butterscotch is. But really, butterscotch pudding is a very traditional custard made from caramelized butter and sugar, brown sugar I like to use because it has such a deep flavor, tempered with milk and cream. And then I decided, well, hell with these people. I'm definitely putting in scotch. And some recipes do put in scotch. But I'm an adult and I like scotch, so I'm going to add scotch. So my version has a little scotch. But you want to make it kiddie friendly, you could certainly leave the scotch out. And as long as you get a deep enough brown butter caramel, it's still going to taste pretty fantastic.
Right on. Mystery solved.
Right, there you go.
And the third thing you said is a killer breakfast sandwich.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Well, let's go make one.
All right.
All right.
Let's go to the kitchen. All right, so here we are down in the kitchen at Haven's Kitchen. Uh-huh. And we're going to make your ultimate breakfast sandwich.
And I hope you think it is, but I'm pretty excited about it. The first thing about a breakfast sandwich to me is obviously the egg has to be cooked well. And by well, I don't mean well done, but I mean so that the yolk is still runny, but not raw, and the white is firm. Most people don't know how to cook a fried egg very well.
It's tough.
They overcook it, they undercook it, etc. So that's the most important part of an egg sandwich to me. But for me, the other components that make it so delicious, obviously, is the cheese.
Okay.
Sharp cheddar.
Got it.
I mean, I'll take American cheese once in a while because, you know, we all have our dirty little secrets. But sharp cheddar cheese, and then a really beautiful ripe tomato. And the few things that I love on my sandwich that I think make it a little bit different and even more delicious are that I always put pickles on my fried egg sandwich. That acid just... so killer. And I like to use chilies, or in this case I'm using peppadews, which are a South African pepper that are sort of mildly spicy and pickled.
Great.
And then mustard. Mustard is my number one favorite condiment of all time. I put mustard on almost anything that it is not embarrassing to put mustard on, even some things that are embarrassing to put mustard on. But I believe mustard makes most things taste better. And so there's always mustard on my egg sandwich. And all together, it's sort of like acid heat. And then fatty cheese and beautiful juicy tomato that has a little bit of acid too, and then that perfect egg. With some lettuce.
I have to say, you come from the hamburger school of breakfast sandwiches.
Yes, the exact same method would make a great hamburger. The first thing I'm gonna do is I'm putting mayonnaise on my bread, on 4 pieces of rye bread. I like rye because it just adds a little flavor. You know, you want every element to have a purpose. And I'm putting it on one side, but this is actually gonna be the outside of the sandwich. And this is sort of the expert grilled cheese school as well, because mayonnaise will help it get golden and tasty. I'm gonna put a little butter in the pan, and I'm using a nonstick skillet here. I definitely don't recommend nonstick skillets for all cooking, but for cooking eggs, it really does help. And you know, you don't need to be a martyr. It's not necessary. So I'm using a nonstick skillet, a big one. That's another thing. You never want a pan that's too small, but then things are crowded and they start to steam, right?
Yeah.
So that's important too. Just move that butter around a little bit, melt it, make sure that it's evenly distributed.
Okay.
And then the first thing you're gonna do is make your egg. And this might come as a surprise to people, but how I like to make my sandwich is that I make my egg separately, put it aside, make the sandwich, and then I put the egg in the middle right before serving it.
Oh, and you like to put the cover on the pan too.
You know, I don't always put a lid over my pan when I'm cooking eggs, but when you put the lid on, it tends to just cook things a little more quickly.
Sure.
As long as, again, you're not blasting that heat. You have to be gentle with your eggs. I do believe also that this is the perfect hangover food. The inspiration for this particular recipe with the mustard and the pickles comes actually from my college years. I went to school in Montreal at McGill University. I was vegetarian for a few years. Don't tell a lot of people that, except everybody who's obviously listening to the show. And there was this burger place in Montreal, and I think it's still around, I'm not sure, that made the most amazing burgers. But because I didn't eat meat, I could never enjoy them. But they had an egg sandwich on the menu that once I ordered it, I craved all the time, and because it had pickles in it. And that was the first time that I'd had an egg sandwich with pickles, and have been eating it that way ever since. So we're almost done here with the egg. I think this is good for me. Is that good for you?
It's beautiful.
I'm just taking my eggs gingerly out of the pan because you don't want to break that yolk.
Oh,
hold on.
It's a high wire act.
And I'm just setting those buttery eggs aside.
They are very beautiful and very buttery looking.
Maybe a little salt.
Season at the end, so you season after they're done.
Yeah, and then I'm going to add the rest of this butter back into the pan, and I'm going to start toasting up my bread and put the sandwich together.
So you're just toasting just the bread, mayonnaise side down, in the butter.
Right. And then once this has started to toast, and not totally toast,
I'm going to spread mustard on the inside of the bread.
Okay.
So a little bit of mustard here.
In the pan, mustarding the bread.
Exactly.
And this is like really like a mustard lover's amount of mustard.
Yeah, I mean, look, you can moderate, but I'm giving you the best version of myself, Francis.
I'm turning down this flame just a hair.
And then I'm going to add peppadews.
Yeah. They're so pretty. They're like so...
I know, they're beautiful.
Dainty little red, bright peppers.
They are, and they have so much flavor.
Yeah.
So I use, for one sandwich, about 5 peppadews cut in half.
But if you didn't have peppadews, any kind of pickled pepper will do.
Absolutely. Any kind
Peter Piper's pickled peppers.
Right. And obviously this is all optional, but I'm just telling you what would make it the best.
And here comes your cheddar on top of the peppers.
Putting in that cheddar, and I'm just going to moderate it to the size of the bread a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, let that start to melt a little bit. And then, when it just starts to warm up the cheese, I'm gonna add pickles, tomato, and a little bit of hot sauce.
Love it. Now you flip the sandwiches, so the new mayonnaise-sided bread goes on the downside.
Exactly. And then at the very end, you're gonna put your lettuce and your egg. There we go. So I'm pulling them off.
Very nice.
Flipping them over, turning off that ferocious stove, and then I'm going to carefully. Now this side, because there's no cheese, is the easier side, right? To slip to open, and carefully first put in your eggs with the crispy edges.
Yeah, show the crisp.
Mm-hmm.
Show the edge.
Piece of lettuce. Put that back there. Don't squish it down too much, although it may pop when I slice it. We'll see. We're going to have to get that beauty shot. All right. Here we go.
Let's commit to the egg yolk.
I mean, you want to be a little bit careful when you slice, but just get in there, and there it goes.
It
oozes a little bit.
Yeah. Bonjour.
Hello, mama. It's a pretty looking sandwich.
That is a pretty looking sandwich.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it.
I'm in.
Good.
Is it good?
I 100% feel the pickles on this.
Good.
All right, thank you so much for this sandwich that's not running down my face.
That's the point. It wouldn't be the ultimate breakfast sandwich if it wasn't.
Gail Simmons' cookbook is called Bringing It Home. You can find her recipe and watch a video of us making her ultimate breakfast sandwich at splendidtable.org. You know, I adore Gail, and it was a blast to get to hang out with her. And it also made me remember this thing that I realized when we were on Top Chef Masters together. There's this almost fetishized idea of having, quote, a good palate, right? It's as if what makes you a good eater is, you know, the ability to detect the 3 grains of cumin in a recipe, or that the tomato sauce has a subtle back note of ginger skin. And sure, yeah, a sensitivity like that is all good, but what I think having a good palate is really about is just being able to talk about what you're tasting. That you can put into words what you're tasting. And I remember our producers would always say to us, look, you're tasting the food for the viewers, so you have to tell us what it's like. And I think you do taste differently if you're thinking about how to describe it. You look for a story to tell. What's the first thing that grabs your attention? Then you think about how the flavor changes, if it mellows out or if it keeps being intense. And then you start to think about other ways to describe a flavor. Maybe you think about it like music. You talk about its rhythm or its depth or its high notes. And the more you do it, the more you come up with different metaphors and comparisons and ways of describing flavors and textures, and the more you start to appreciate what it is you're tasting. Because now you've really spent the time and effort to really take notice of it. So, you know, I'm not a restaurant critic, but I've played one on TV, and I can tell you that you too can eat like a restaurant critic. You just have to sit down, dig in, and really pay attention. Coming up, a deep dive into the world of vinegar and why you may be cooking sous vide in your home soon. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. The show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. Now, if you ever end up a contestant on Chef's Talk Family Feud, here's my advice. You just go up there and say the word acid. I guarantee you the host goes, survey says, the board flips, acid lights up, and you take home fabulous prizes. And that's because chefs are always talking about how a splash of acidic vinegar is what elevates a dish. And Michael Harlan Turkel should know. He spent his whole career around chefs, first as a cook himself, and then as a photographer and a writer, and he's made himself an expert on vinegars. He's traveled the world for them, he infuses them, and yes, he makes them in his apartment. Our contributor, Shauna Seaver, talked with Michael about bringing this restaurant secret weapon home.
Hi, Michael. Thanks so much for talking with us.
How you doing? Thanks for having me.
So you have to tell us how your obsession with the world of vinegar came about.
I think the same way most people make vinegar the first time, accidentally, leaving a bottle of red wine out and open on the table. But it kind of snowballed into a couple other alcohols and had a leftover quarter keg that I poured into a barrel, and it turned into the best malt vinegar I've ever had in my life.
So definitely a happy accident.
It is, and now it's an absurd obsession.
Now, your book reveals vinegar to be so much more versatile in the kitchen than we might realize. So can you tell us about some of the main functions in cooking and in baking?
Yeah, vinegar is a flavor carrier. It's not just this overt thing that kind of punches you in the chest and makes you cough. It is a vehicle for a lot of other flavors to kind of commingle and coalesce. So, you know, when you make a vinaigrette, either 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 ratio oil to vinegar, you're actually trying to express the nuances and aroma in the vinegar by carrying it in that fat. And that kind of carries over in a lot of cooking processes. It deglazes pans to pick up the fond. It stabilizes egg whites and meringues. It is a really interesting part of cooking because as overt as we think it is actually about the balance and harmony in a lot of other cuisines.
And of course, in baking, vinegar is used in so many old-fashioned baking recipes to react with the leavening agents as well.
Oh, absolutely. That science experiment of baking soda and vinegar, you know, shooting up like a volcano certainly is kind of like what Irish soda bread is, you know, using that as a faux leaven.
One of the things I found so fascinating in your book is that you chose to organize part of the book by different cuisines across the globe. Give us some examples of vinegars that are unique to certain places and how they're used.
I'm going to go chronologically like the book. First, I got to go to France and Italy, Austria and Japan, then back all through North America. And in France, you know, there's a lot of butter, a lot of cream, and it's delicious because of those things. But those sauces have vinegar in them, have some kind of acidity to balance all that out. You find vinegar in Bernays, you find vinegar in Hollandaise, and most of the master sauces, but it's not necessarily the thing that we first think of as the primary ingredient. And moving to Italy, I just got back from a trip in Emilia-Romagna region where balsamic is king. And balsamic's another thing. It's probably the most ubiquitous vinegar around the world now, but the amount that's made for Tradizionale, which is the original balsamic vinegar, which really wasn't exported to the States, if not world, until like the 1970s, such a small amount is made that a lot of people haven't even experienced it. So seeing that vinegar in context and seeing that it's barely used as an application where you heat it up, it's, you know, on top of a little aged Parmesan or strawberries or maybe to accent a stuffed pasta. Then in Austria, I think quite possibly the greatest vinegar maker in the world lives in Vienna. And he is singular in that he makes vinegars from single ingredients, tomato, saffron, red pepper, trockenbeeren, auslesen, and makes these things that are so linear and pure that I've never tasted a vinegar so expressive of its, you know, inherent self.
And then you have things like rice vinegars, rice wine vinegars, and in Asian cuisines.
This was another thing that I'd only really experienced, you know, Kikkoman or Mizkan or Marukan rice vinegars, the things you buy in supermarkets. But when you taste a real rice vinegar, it's kind of like taking, you know, a shot of sake or a sip of sake for the first time. There is so much expression. There is so much terroir to it. And rice vinegar can be the same way. There isn't just acidity. There is flavor, depending on what kind of rice they use and how much it's polished down. And on top of that, you know, the traditional rice vinegar, komizu, is probably the standard, the gold standard of rice vinegars in Japan. But then there's akasu, this red vinegar made from the aged marome or sake lees. and it literally turns almost black in Hinoki wooden boxes before it's pressed. Then there's Kurotsu from the southwest, the Kyushu province, and it's black vinegar that's used more as a drinking vinegar than it is as something in culinary practices.
That's fascinating. There are so many different flavors of vinegar, and we know about things like, say, you know, tarragon vinegar, where you're steeping an herb in the vinegar. But what are some of the elements, maybe some of the more scientific elements, that give vinegars their distinct flavors?
Well, vinegar is nothing more than 4 to 6% acetic acid in solution, and that solution is water. So kind of like wine, there are all these volatile esters, these aromas that are carried within that solution. So that's what you're tasting and that's what you're smelling. So when you're making an infusion, you're encapsulating whatever that aroma is in that solution, and it pairs with acetic acid and, you know, kind of goes through that olfactory motion of tasting and smelling. But vinegar is often a sensation before it's a flavor. So you taste that on your palate. You have that, you know, feeling of brightness, of enlivening. It makes you salivate a little bit. And that's when it hits. That's when the flavors get picked up. So like I had been saying before, it is a carrier, but the thing that it initially does is open up your palate to be able to experience those flavors.
If anyone's going to get us to make vinegar at home, it's going to be you. So tell us, what are some of the basic tools we need to get started?
Well, first you need a good juice. Vinegar is made from any starch that can convert into a sugar that can turn into an alcohol and then eventually become vinegar or acetic acid. So you have to find one of those bases. Starches include grains and rices. Sugars include honey and cane, fruits and vegetables as well. So you have to define what you want to make it of because you have to figure out what you're going to use it for. Then after that, it's kind of like any home brewing. You just need a kit that can carry that solution, some kind of vessel, and I suggest glass, maybe a ceramic crock, wood if you're adventurous. And then after that, there are a couple other tools. The first thing, if you're making your own alcohol, is a refractometer. It looks like this little clarinet, and it checks the bricks or the sugar content. The next thing you use is a hydrometer, and it looks like this floating kind of temperature gauge. It bobs up and down in solution. It tells you what the potential ABV or alcohol by volume output's going to be. Then after that, little litmus test called pH strips, and they tell you what percentage of acidity in solution. So anywhere from 2.8 to about 3.4 is what you're aiming for. So you dip those into, you know, your liquid, you take it out, it changes a certain color, and you check on that scale whether or not you're in that range. But aside from that, time and patience.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this really great modern take on an ingredient that goes back centuries. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Harlan Turkell is author of Acid Trip, Travels in the World of Vinegar. And Shauna Seaver's latest book is Real Sweet. And if you go to splendidtable.org, you can find a recipe from Michael's book they'll probably both agree on. Vinegar pie with a sweet, tart, custardy filling from Underbelly Restaurant in Houston. I remember the first time I ever ate meat cooked sous vide. Now, this is a method of cooking where you put the food into a plastic pouch and essentially poach it in a water bath. And this was just after I'd graduated from culinary school, where I thought I'd been taught all the possible ways to cook a steak. So I had no idea what to think of this piece of beef that was absolutely perfect medium rare, top to bottom, with no gray ring around the pink. It was one of the juiciest, most tender things I'd ever eaten. Now that was at a cutting-edge restaurant almost 15 years ago. But now, sous vide is on the verge of showing up in homes everywhere. The equipment is getting cheaper and cheaper, and you know, the idea of cooking something perfectly every time is pretty irresistible. Our friend Molly Birnbaum from America's Test Kitchen is here to talk about cooking sous vide at home. Hi Molly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the basics. What is sous vide cooking?
So sous vide cooking is a relatively new technique to enter the land of home cooks. The name comes from the French for under vacuum, and that's because you seal food in plastic, and then you cook this food in a water bath that's heated to a very precise temperature with something called a sous vide circulator, which is basically an electronic stick that you put into a pot or a plastic container, something that's heat safe. And this stick you can program to a particular temperature, and it will heat that water to that temperature and then keep it there for as long as you want. And so when you're cooking this food sealed in plastic in this water bath, the goal is to bring that food up to the exact temperature of the water bath. And that's usually the serving temperature of the food. So it's incredibly precise.
Yeah. So I remember it was a revelation to me to learn. Actually, I can't believe I had to like go to cooking school to learn this, but a medium rare steak is 125 degrees. And so once you know those numbers, then you can say, I want a medium rare steak. I can set my water bath to 125. You put the food in the plastic, you put it in there, and it'll be medium rare for, you know, until you feel like eating it.
Exactly. And then all you need to do is a quick sear on the stovetop to give it that crusty brown crust that you love, mm-hmm. and it's done. It's perfect. Also, sous vide gives you time back because you're putting food in the bath, and then you can walk away. What I like to do when I'm circulating food for dinner is make a side salad, make a sauce.
It's really romantic to say, hey, I'm going to go circulate dinner now.
Our test cooks call it swimming. So they're going to go swim something right now, which I think is nice.
I like that. I like that.
So sous vide, it gives you time back, which is really nice for dinner parties or just weeknight dinners. I think that sous vide gets a bad rap for being too techy or too sciencey or something that you really have to understand Celsius and Fahrenheit and time and temperature graphs, etc. But it's not. It's incredibly simple. You can put food in a Ziploc bag, stick it in a water bath heated to the precise temperature, and then you can walk away. And that is really wonderful, especially because there's no danger of overcooking your food.
Right. What's the effect of time? Like you said, if you have a piece of, say, beef at 125 degrees, that's always going to be medium rare. Does it matter if it stays there for 20 minutes or if it stays there for 24 hours? For instance, I saw a chef once advertise on their menu, these short ribs were braised sous vide for 72 hours. Did that make a difference than if you did it for 48 hours or 53 hours? Like what is, if it's presumably it's all the same temperature?
That's an excellent question. And I think one of the most interesting things about sous vide is that it's about temperature, of course, but it's also about time. And you can play with those two things together in ways that you can't do with traditional cooking. You can do some very interesting things with meat held at lower temperatures for a longer period of time. For example, we've been working with chuck roast, which is a relatively cheap piece of meat. It has a lot of collagen. It has a lot of fat. Traditionally, you would cook it at a higher temperature for a number of hours to break down that collagen and get it to be really tender. But for sous vide, we've been tying this chuck into a roast-like shape, something that looks a little bit more compact and beautiful. And then we're sous viding it at 133 degrees Fahrenheit for 24 hours straight. So that's a long time in a relatively low temperature bath. And when this thing is done, it is like a prime rib. All that time in the bath keeps it bright pink. It's incredibly tender and juicy. It tastes beefier than anything I've ever tasted. And it's cooked perfectly evenly from end to end. And then there's also something to enzymes that are active at this lower temperature. There's more of them active when you're keeping something at this low temperature. It's the same that happens when you're dry aging steak. So when you're doing this low temperature cooking, you really are tenderizing meat and having it become more flavorful.
I have to ask you a question though. I was talking to people like, oh, I'm going to do this interview. And a friend of mine said, you need to ask this question. And that is, what's the deal with cooking, as you said, sealed in a plastic bag? Is that okay? Is that safe? Is there like gnarly stuff that's going to leach into our food? Like, honestly, for me, I kind of feel like if that's what does me in, so be it. But I can respect not everyone feels that way. So is there anything to be afraid of with cooking in plastic like that?
Right. That's a question we get all the time. And I get it. There's a lot of stuff out there about how plastic containing BPA, which is an industrial chemical, is harmful if it's heated, that it can leach into the food. The good news is that all plastic bags that are created for sous vide or for cryovacking or vacuum sealing are incredibly safe. And even better, all of the good quality plastic bags like by Ziploc, the freezer safe Ziploc bags are also safe. They're not made with BPA. They're made from polyethylene and polypropylene, which have been shown to be very safe when it comes to cooking and heat. And also, sous vide isn't necessarily cooking in plastic. You can cook in mason jars, which are glass. When you're cooking eggs, they can cook right in their shell.
Oh, that's amazing. So, okay, so aside from perfectly cooked meat and fish, what other things can you play with in sous vide?
So when I started working in sous vide at America's Test Kitchen, I really thought it was about meat and about eggs, and that was kind of it. But as we've been working on this book from the science team, we've been diving into recipes that surprised me. For example, homemade yogurt. You just bring milk up to an almost boil to kill bacteria, add a little bit of starter, which can be yogurt that you already have, put it into mason jars, and then circulate it at 110 degrees Fahrenheit for anywhere between 5 and 12 hours, depending on how tangy like your yogurt in the end.
Oh, I love that.
That's it. And it's so foolproof because you don't have to worry about having it in a low oven or anything like that, or having to monitor a pot on the stove. You just put it in, and then anywhere between 5 and 12 hours later, you're done. And it's delicious. And then we've also been making ricotta.
Oh, cool.
Desserts. Sous vide is actually a thing. We haven't gotten to the dessert chapter yet, but we have plans to make creme brulee, pudding, dulce de leche. Very excited to start testing that.
Oh, awesome. All right, and there are a lot of these circulators now out on the market. You guys have done a test of the best ones, right?
That's right. Our tasting and testing team has dove into all of the circulators that are currently out there, and there are a ton of options for the home cook, and they actually picked a winner, which is called the Jewel Circulator. And it's small, and it's sleek, and it is incredibly accurate. It's really wonderful.
And about how much is the Jewel?
So the Jewel is around $200, and this is much cheaper than the first generation of sous vide devices used to be. They used to be a lot thicker, a lot slower. Now they're very light, very easy, very fast, and they work very well. They're also connected to Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, so the Jewel works via an app on your smartphone, which is pretty convenient.
And they used to be like $1,000, so 200 is way, way cheaper now, too. So I guess it's time to start circulating dinner. Thanks so much for coming in, Molly.
Thanks for having me.
Molly Birnbaum is executive editor of Science at America's Test Kitchen. You can find their sous vide recipe for Mexican roast pork, cochinita pibil, at splendidtable.org. Coming up, I get to talk with you. And we have a love story that evolved over oysters. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. All right, now it's time for us to talk. You can find us always on Facebook or Twitter, or pick up that phone, 1-800-537-5252. We want to know what you're cooking and thinking about, so let's do it. We have Amanda on the line from Decatur, Georgia. Hey, Amanda, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. What would you like to talk about?
So about a year ago, I went to my friend's bridal shower, and she got this beautiful Le Creuset brazier, and I was so jealous, and I couldn't stop talking about it. So my boyfriend got me one single little cocotte as a joke, and then for my birthday this year, he got me the brazier and a set of cocottes because I could finally make something with them. But the problem is I don't know what to make with them. I've experimented a little bit. I've made some stuff with chicken legs in the brazier. I've made some baked eggs in the cocottes, but that's really all I know how to do. And I would love to be able to use them more and show off, you know, these great gifts.
All right. So you got as a gift a big cast iron and enameled cast iron brazier. About what size is it?
I would say probably either 12 or 14 inches. Pretty large.
Oh, big. Yeah, like a big old guy. Oh, cool. And then you have some cast iron cocottes, which are like, they're basically like little mini braziers, right? And how big are those? Are they a little smaller?
Yeah, kind of like similar in shape to a ramekin.
Oh, okay. So with those, I have to say, they're really cute. Like, they're really adorable. I think baked eggs or shirred eggs or, you know, something like that really kind of, they're just so pretty in there. And honestly, I don't own that type of pot because I have to be honest, at home, I cook a little bit more Neanderthal-ish, so I don't use them a whole lot. But I think, yeah, something like that, like a single serving of maybe like a, if you want to do like a spoon bread in there, or like, you know, do it on the side at a really nice dinner
or do for like a breakfast or brunch, like exactly if you're doing a beautiful little baked eggs with a little bit of cream in there, maybe a slice or two of country ham, and just sort of low heat in the oven, just sort of gently bake. They're just so beautiful that way, and you take off the top and it's just such a pretty presentation. Mm-hmm. But your 12 or 14 inch brazier, no, there we're talking, because that mm-hmm. is a really fun piece of equipment to have. I think for that, I want to talk to you about, in general, what I think that kind of pot does really well. Mm-hmm. So what I think is beautiful about like a big cast iron enameled brazier, like you say, is A, it's cast iron, so it holds heat really well. And I think people want to usually think about that in terms of like, oh, that means you can crank the heat up and like get like amazing, like hardcore searing action in there, which you certainly can. But for me, I think what's exciting about that is that it can actually hold heat really evenly when you're cooking at a less intense temperature. And so what that means to me is if you're searing, say, you know, short ribs, if you want to do some braised short ribs, or if you want to braise chicken and you want to sear the skin, or you want to do something like a pork shoulder, you know, like a nice sort of like heartier cut of meat, I think what's great is you can get that thing hot, but only like medium heat or medium high heat instead of having to like rip it up to all the way high. You know what I mean? And, you know, get your oil in there, get your proteins like pat dry with paper towel, season them, lay them in there gently. And what's really nice about that is you can get such a more intense or like a deeper sear is maybe a better way to describe it. And the pan holds that heat so well. And you can take 15 minutes, you know, to get a good sear on all four sides of a short rib, you know, like really take your time with it. And you get this really beautiful crust that, you know, it doesn't burn it because you're not having it over such a crazy flame, but it'll mm-hmm. just really get that sear nice and deep into the cut. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And that's something I didn't really think about with that piece of equipment, because I associated it with kind of stewing or braising or, you know, longer, not more seared things, more moist things.
Yeah. And what's really awesome then, though, is once you get that really nice dark sear, then what you do is you also get, you know, all those great sticky brown bits on the bottom that haven't burnt. So then you continue to use that to braise, like you say, in the stew. And that's when you add your liquid. You can add, you know, beer or wine or stock or, you know, whatever you're using. And it just builds so much flavor. And then you put it in there, put the lid on, put it in the oven. And I just think it's great for that kind of cooking. It looks beautiful when you pull out of the oven and you can, you know, take the lid off and just serve it right in the pot, because it's just going to be such a cool, rustic, beautiful dish. What a gift. It's also like, it's one of those gifts. It's like, It's like, oh, I gave you this thing and now you'll cook food and I get to eat out of it too.
it was perfect for both of us for me to get this gift.
Terrific. Well, enjoy it. I'm so glad to hear that you got the gift that you wanted.
Thank you. I'm excited to use it.
All right. Let us know how it goes. Let us know what you're making it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
So we have a question from an anonymous caller. Hopefully it's not because they're ashamed of their question, but so this gentleman bought a contraption to make zucchini noodles, and he wants to learn how to cook the zucchini noodles like noodles. They turn out mushy when he does them, and he'd really prefer them to be more al dente. I don't know exactly how this gentleman's cooking his zucchini noodles, but I think my first gut reaction is to say probably what you want to do is cook them in smaller batches than what you're doing over higher heat. Because what happens is when you have, you know, it's still zucchini. They're going to look like beautiful linguine or whatever, but it's still zucchini. And zucchini, A, cooks really fast and gets soft really fast. And if you have a big pile of it in a pan, then what's going to happen is, you know, the stuff on the surface of the pan is cooking and getting soft, and the stuff in the middle isn't quite cooked yet. So what I would suggest is divide it into small batches, maybe just a handful at a time, and get your pan ripping hot, put in some nice oil, maybe aromatics, whatever you want to do, whatever the recipe is, and just give them a quick toss in the pan just until they soften up on the outside. Take them out, start over, and just do that until you get all your zucchini cooked. All right, so a little while ago, we asked y'all for your secret ingredients. So let us know what are the things that you use that, you know, that we might have never thought to use. And we have Erica on the line from Seattle right now to tell us about hers. Hey, Erica, how are you?
Hi, Francis. I'm good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So what is your secret ingredient?
So my secret ingredient is an umami powder.
All right, I'm listening.
Kombu, and bonito flakes and shiitake mushrooms that are pulverized to a very fine powder. And I've used it on things, you know, for baked chicken, for example, the typical things like burgers and meatloaf. Oh. But I recently did it on a savory oatmeal that was phenomenal.
Oh, cool. Wait, so do you buy this?
No, I've made it. I can tell you the recipe if you'd like.
Yeah, please do.
About 6 tablespoons of bonito flakes and then 1 ounce each of shiitake mushrooms and kombu.
Okay, so kombu seaweed.
Yes, kombu the seaweed. The dried seaweed, and you don't have to reconstitute it or anything like that. You just use it as is. And I usually do have to break it up a little bit more just to have it fit in the grinder. And then I grind it either in a blender or a coffee grinder. That usually works better because it really gives it to this nice fine powder. Then that's it. And I use it on a lot of different foods. It adds a really nice depth, obviously an umami flavor to things. So it can make it taste like a seafood soup has been cooking for a lot longer than it has. It's a fun ingredient.
That's super cool. So the kombu, the kelp, the dried kelp, and the dried bonito flakes, now those are typically the ingredients you use to make dashi, which is this Japanese stock. It's like their version of chicken stock where you use it everywhere, but usually you steep it like a tea with those two ingredients, and instead you're just pulverizing them with shiitake mushrooms. So you get like super ultra umami action. Oh, I love that. So you sprinkle it on things as a seasoning, but also to like infuse flavor into other sauces and broths and stuff.
Yeah.
Did you say you used it with eggs?
Actually, with the savory oatmeal that I make using my umami powder, is I'll mix it in with the oatmeal and then I did a soft boiled egg on top. So I'll add in, if I'm doing steel cut oats, I'll do about 1 cup of the steel cut oats with about 4 cups of water. And I'll just add in 1 teaspoon of the umami powder and then cook it down so that it's already mixed in there. And then I usually top it with some soft baked crunchy kale and a soft boiled egg. And that's really it for a savory breakfast.
Oh, it's delicious sounding.
Yeah, it's perfect on winter days.
Yeah, you know, I grew up eating kanji or juk, you know, the rice porridge for breakfast, and we always had it savory. And, you know, in the sort of more Western style, people think of porridges as being sweet, butter, brown sugar, cinnamon, that's great. But I love that beautiful, savory, you know, warm bowl in the morning.
Yeah, I agree. I think because of the congee idea, I just thought about putting kimchi on top of it too. That would be really good.
Oh, totally.
Or soy sauce to even bring out that umami even more.
Yeah. So I can imagine putting it into liquid things. And if you put it in a sauce, then it'll extract that flavor. But how do you use it dry?
I think I sort of think of it like the Japanese seasoning furikake. It's got seaweed, usually sometimes sesame seeds, sometimes dried.
Little crispy bits.
Sake, yeah, crispy bits. And it kind of adds a similar flavor to that. So it's almost like salt, I guess.
So you just like sprinkle it on a piece of fish or a piece of chicken before you cook it or something?
Yes. Yeah, I've definitely done fish because it really seems to enhance that flavor. And then chicken, I usually bake with it. So I guess that sort of does the same thing. Oh, I've done like a ricotta cheese with the umami powder in it and then some other herbs and mix that in and put that on some toast.
Oh, I love that. That sounds awesome.
With some tomatoes. And yeah, that was really good too. It just adds this depth that I've been addicted to ever since I discovered it.
That's cool. Where'd you get the idea?
I was trying to think about it actually, and I don't remember. I grew up in Japan, so I've used a lot of these ingredients for years. I was trying to remember. I made it for Christmas once as a present for all of my family and friends. I gave that out.
Yeah. All right, Erica. Well, this is such a super cool idea. I can't wait to go and blend some up. So thank you so much for the idea and the call.
Oh, you're so welcome. I hope you enjoy it as much as I have been.
I know I will.
Thanks, Francis.
Thank you.
Bye.
Man, that is such a good idea. So Erica said 6 tablespoons of bonito flakes and 1 ounce each of dried shiitake mushrooms and kombu, and you just whirl them up in a blender or spice mill until they're pulverized, and there you go. That is your put-on-everything umami powder. That's such a cool idea. So please keep them coming. We'd love to hear about your secret weapons. and get to us on Facebook or Twitter, or pick up that phone, 1-800-537-5252. You know that moment when you're just getting to know someone, and all of a sudden they say that one thing that totally changes the way you see them? Well, sometimes that thing, you know, turns you away, but sometimes it pulls you in, as with this story from the writer Tejal Rao.
I met a man from Long Island at a bar by chance a year after I moved to New York, and right away I liked him. We walked from the bar to a 24-hour diner in the East Village and got grilled cheese sandwiches and French fries and drank bad room-temperature coffee and talked for hours, until a stranger came over and asked if we'd like him to officiate our wedding, right there at the sticky table by the bathroom. By then it was light outside. I'd known the man for 9 hours, and I was powered by an engine of pure enthusiasm. I said, sure, why not? Yes. Our waitress rolled her eyes, but agreed to be the witness as we smeared an unofficial document with ketchup. Not long after, I learned that the man I'd diner married had worked for many years opening clams and oysters in bars, and it had left him with a calm, clear-eyed appreciation. What I mean is, he didn't get worked up when he talked about oysters, not like some people I knew. He didn't insist that I try one particular variety, grown off one remote island with nothing but a squirt of lemon, because anything more would be disrespectful to the oyster. I liked oysters just fine, but not that much. When I ate them raw by the dozen, they were occasionally delicious, fat and intact and salty, slipping out of pristine shells. Just as often, they were nothing special, like mouthfuls of bland, brackish jelly, or the sweat off coins from deep pockets, or the fermented milk of a mythical sea creature. They didn't seem worth the hassle. But there was something about the way he liked oysters, keenly and quietly, without fetish or hyperbole, that made me reconsider. We carried 100, along with a jar of chopped shallots and vinegar, to my friend's apartment one New Year's Eve. We ate them smoked on crackers and hot in pan roasts, and when we visited friends in New Orleans, roasted in garlic butter, freckled with pulverized anchovies and cayenne pepper. Then we walked down the street with grease stains on our clothes toward music. When my parents came to visit the apartment we shared, I blitzed butter in a food processor with hot sauce, lemon zest, and garlic. He sat at the table outside and talked and opened oysters with them while I lit the charcoal for my tiny travel-size grill. It took a few minutes for the butter to start bubbling, to make a tangy, fatty sauce with the oyster liquor, and for the meat to heat through. Then we ate in rounds, putting a dozen or so half-shells on the grill every time we ran out. What my mother wanted to know, after we'd emptied a bottle of wine, was if he and I ever talked about getting married. Not that she minded us living together. No, it wasn't that. Not that it mattered these days, not at all. She wasn't old-fashioned, she insisted. But it would be so nice to know more about my long-term plans. I told her the truth, that I didn't have any long-term plans, but that the oysters on the grill couldn't wait. Oysters were like that.
Tejal Rao is a reporter for the New York Times and a columnist for the New York Times Magazine. This story is from her article, Oysters, a Love Story. And that's our show for the week. Thank you so much for listening, and, you know, please join us again next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this quote from Zora Neale Hurston, who wrote, "I do not weep at the world. I am too busy sharpening my oyster knife." Hey, you can always find tons of great stuff at splendidtable.org. Take a look at our recipe collection, sign up for our email newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, check out our videos, or subscribe to our podcasts. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell, Jenny Lubke is our editor and technical director, Erica Romero is our assistant producer, Chip Walton is our digital associate producer, and Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM. American Public Media.